There's been a large swell since yesterday, he recorded. But it is doing us no harm now, since our flow is broken up so small. It rises and falls with... He never finished the sentence. There was a heavy thump, and the flow split under the James Caird. Worsley was on watch, and he shouted for help. All hands dashed from their tents and seized the James Caird just as the crack began to widen. The other two boats, which were on the separated portion of the flow, were hurried across. When it was over, the flow was a triangle of ice, whose sides measured roughly 100 by 120 by 90 yards. Not long after midnight, the wind shifted from the west to the southeast and dropped considerably. Almost at once, great pools of open water appeared as the flows drew apart. But it didn't last. By daybreak, the ice had closed again, though the sky to the north grew black as ink. The swell increased, and the men had to brace themselves slightly as they made their way about. Again, at breakfast time, the ice mysteriously moved apart again. Small floes became isolated patches of white floating on the dark, cold surface of the water. But even as the entire party anxiously watched, the pack closed once more. The swell rose higher on all sides, and their flow began to take a serious pounding. Toward mid-morning, for the third time, lanes and pools of open water unaccountably spread through the pack and widened. At 10:30, Shackleton's booming brogue rang out, "Strike the tents and clear the boats!" The men jumped to their tasks. In minutes, the tents were struck, and the sleeping bags gathered and stowed in the bows of the boats. Then, one at a time, the boats were pushed on their sledges to the edge of the flow. Crack! Again the flow had split in two, this time exactly through the spot where Shackleton's tent had stood some minutes before. The two halves drew rapidly apart, separating the Stancomb Wills and a large amount of provisions from the rest of the party. Almost everyone leapt over the widening breach and shoved the cutter and the stores across. Then they waited. Torn between the overpowering desire to launch the boats regardless of the risk, and the certain knowledge that once they did so, there could be no turning back. Small as it was, theirs was the only decent flow in sight. If they abandoned it, and the pack closed up before they reached another campsite, there would be no escape. Throughout the activity, Green had gone methodically about his duties. Now he was ready with some oily seal soup and a serving of hot powdered milk. Each man took his portion and ate it standing up, intently watching the pack all the while. It was 12:30, and the pools of water were very slightly larger. The man looked at Shackleton. For the moment, the pack was open. But how long would it remain open? And yet, how long could they stay where they were? The immense flow that had once been Patience Camp was now an irregular rectangle of ice hardly 50 yards across. How long would it be before it was broken and ground to bits beneath their feet? At 12:40, Shackleton gave the order in a quiet voice. Launch the boats. The flow came alive with activity. Green ran to his stove and put out the fire. Other men took pieces of canvas and tied up small piles of meat and blubber. The rest of the party hurried to the boats. The Dudley Docker was removed from its sledge and eased into the water. Then, with all hands passing stores, she was loaded with cases of rations, a bag of meat, the blubber stove, and Number 5's rattly old hoop tent. An empty sledge was lowered into the water and tied onto her stern. Next, the Stancomb Wills was rapidly launched and loaded, and finally, the James Caird. It was 1:30 in the afternoon when the crews scrambled on board each boat. They put out every available oar and pulled with all their strength for the open water. Even as they drew away from Patience Camp, the ice began to close. Part 4, Chapter 1. The first few minutes were crucial, and they were maddening. The oarsmen did their best to pull together, but they were clumsy and out of practice, and hampered by their own anxiety. The encircling ice fouled the oars, and collisions were unavoidable. Men crouched in the bows of each boat and tried to pole off the bigger pieces of ice, but a great many outweighed the boats themselves. The raised sides of the James Caird and the Dudley Docker were an added hindrance. They made the seats too low for proper rowing, and though cases of stores were placed under the four oarsmen in each boat, it was still an awkward business. The sledge astern of the Dudley Docker continually got hung up on bits of ice, and after a few minutes, Worsley angrily cut it loose. And yet, to their surprise, and almost in spite of themselves, and the jealous hands that tried to hold them back, they were making headway. With each boat length, the ice seemed looser. It was difficult to tell whether the pack was opening or whether they were escaping from the ice surrounding Patience Camp. In either case, for the moment, luck was on their side. The overcast sky seemed almost alive with birds. Cape pigeons, terns, fulmars, and Antarctic silver-grey and snow petrels, by the thousands. The birds were so thick, their droppings spattered on the boats and forced the rowers to keep their heads lowered. Whales, too, seemed everywhere. They surfaced on all sides, sometimes frighteningly close, especially the killers. The James Caird was in the lead, with Shackleton at the tiller. So far as the ice permitted, he set a course for the northwest. Next came Worsley steering the Dudley Docker, then Hudson in the Stancomb Wills. The sound of their voices chanting, "Stroke! Stroke! Stroke!" mingled with the cries of the birds overhead and the surge of the swell through the pack. With each stroke, the oarsmen fell more into the rhythm of their task. In 15 minutes, Patience Camp was lost in the confusion of ice astern. But Patience Camp no longer mattered. That soot-blackened floe, which had been their prison for nearly 4 months, whose every feature they knew so well, as convicts know each crevice of their cells, which they had come to despise, but whose preservation they had prayed for so often, belonged now to the past. They were in the boats. Actually in the boats, and that was all that mattered. They thought neither of Patience Camp nor of an hour hence. There was only the present, and that meant row, get away, escape. Within 30 minutes they had entered an area of very open pack, and by 2:30 they were easily a mile away from Patience Camp. They could not have found it again, even if they had wanted. Their course carried them close to a high, flat-topped berg, which was taking a terrific pounding from the northwest swell. The seas broke against its ice-blue sides, flinging spray 60 feet into the air. Just as they drew a beam of it, they became aware of a deep, hoarse noise that was rapidly getting louder. Looking to starboard, they saw a lava-like flow of churning, tumbling ice at least 2 feet high and as wide as a small river bearing down on them out of the east-southeast. It was a tide rip, a phenomenon of current thrown up from the ocean floor which had caught a mass of ice and was propelling it forward at about 3 knots. For a moment, they stared in disbelief. Then Shackleton swung the bow of the James Caird to port and shouted for the other two boats to follow. The oarsmen dug in their feet and pulled with all their strength away from the onrushing ice. Even so, it was gaining on them. The rowers were facing astern, looking straight at the ice, almost at eye level as it drove toward them. Those men who were not rowing urged the oarsmen on, counting cadence for them and stamping their feet at the same time. The Dudley Docker was the most cumbersome boat to row, and twice she was almost overtaken, but she just managed to keep clear. After 15 minutes, as the strength of the men at the oars began to fail them, the tide rip showed signs of flattening out. 5 minutes later, it seemed to lose its strength, and before long, it had disappeared as mysteriously as it had arisen. Fresh men took over the oars from the weary rowers, and Shackleton brought the James Caird back onto a northwest course. The wind gradually swung around to the southeast, so that it was blowing from astern, and it greatly aided their progress. The position when the boats were launched was 61 degrees 56 minutes south, 53 degrees 56 minutes west, near the eastern reaches of what is called Bransfield Strait. Bransfield Strait is about 200 miles long and 60 miles wide, lying between the Palmer Peninsula and the South Shetland Islands. It connects the hazardous Drake Passage with the waters of the Weddell Sea. and it is a treacherous place. It was named in honour of Edward Bransfield, who in 1820 took a small brig named the Williams into the waters which now bear his name. According to the British, Bransfield was thus the first man ever to set eyes on the Antarctic continent. In the 96 years between the time of Bransfield's discovery and that afternoon of April the 9th, 1916, when Shackleton's men threaded their boats through the ice, precious little had been learned about conditions in these unfrequented waters. Even today, the U.S. Navy Department's sailing directions for Antarctica, in describing conditions in Bransfield Strait, begins with an apologetic explanation that there is a paucity of information about the area. It is believed, the sailing directions continue, that strong erratic currents are to be found, sometimes reaching a velocity of 6 knots. These currents are affected only slightly by the wind, so that often a condition known to sailors as a cross sea is set up, when the wind is blowing in one direction and the current moving in another. At such times, angry hunks of water, 3, 6, 10 feet high, are heaved upwards, much as when breakers are thrown back from a bulkhead, and collide with incoming waves. A cross sea is a perilous thing to a small boat. Furthermore, the weather in Bransfield Strait is reliably inhospitable. Some reports say the sky is clear only 10% of the time. Snows are heavy and gales are common, beginning in the middle of February and becoming more frequent and more violent as the Antarctic winter draws closer. The boats in which the party set sail upon this forbidding sea were sturdy enough, but no open boat was really equal to the voyage they faced. The Dudley Docker and the Stancomb Wills were cutters, heavy, square-stern boats of solid oak. Their Norwegian builders called them bottlenose killer boats, or dreperbats, because they were originally designed for hunting bottlenose whales. In the bow of each was a stout post to which the harpoon line was intended to be fastened. They were 21 feet 9 inches long, with a 6-foot 2-inch beam, and they had 3 seats, or thwarts, plus a small decking in the bow and in the stern. They also mounted stubby masts, to which a sail could be secured, but they were primarily pulling boats, designed for rowing, not sailing. The only real difference between the two was that McNeish had added planks to the Dudley Docker, which raised her sides about 8 inches. The James Caird was a double-ended whaleboat, 22 feet 6 inches long and 6 feet 3 inches wide. She had been built in England to Worsley's specifications of Baltic pine planking over a framework of American elm and English oak. Though she was somewhat larger than the other two, she was a lighter, springier boat because of the materials of which she was built. McNeish had raised her sides about 15 inches, so that even fully loaded, she rose a little more than 2 feet out of the water. The Caird was thus by far the most seaworthy of the three. In terms of weight, the boats were not overloaded. The Wills carried 8 men, the Docker 9, and the Caird 11. In less stormy waters with less bulky gear, each might have accommodated at least twice that number. As matters stood, the boats were uncomfortably crowded. The hoop tents and the rolled-up sleeping bags took up a disproportionate amount of room. There were also cases of stores and a considerable amount of personal gear, all of which left scarcely enough space for the men themselves. Throughout the afternoon, as they held to a northwesterly course, the three boats made excellent progress. There were belts of ice that were fairly thick, but none so dense as to block their way. Shortly after 5 o'clock, the light began to fail. Shackleton called to the other boats to stay close by until a suitable camping place was found. They rowed until about 5:30, when they came to a flat, heavy floe some 200 yards across, which Shackleton decided was sturdy enough to camp on. Nearly a half dozen approaches were made in the surging swell before the boats were safely hauled onto the ice. It was 6:15 by the time the landing was completed. Green set up his blubber stove, while the remainder of the party pitched the tents, except for number 5, which was so flimsy that Shackleton granted permission for its occupants to sleep in the boats. Supper consisted of a quarter pound of dog pemmican and two biscuits apiece. It was finished by 8 o'clock, and all hands except the watch turned in. It had been a tiring but exciting day.